someplace there's got to be a place where people are free to discuss what they know and what they don't know and to find out what they can.
Radioactive Waves is presented by the National Museum of Nuclear Science and History. Together, we will explore all things atomic, nuclear, and radioactive, along with some interesting surprises from our museum's collections and connections.
Hello, welcome to the podcast. How are you doing, David?
I am doing wonderful. I can actually see you. I'm sitting across the table from Anna today, which is a new experience for us.
Yeah.
We have been up to this point recording, not virtually, but virtually.
Digitally, yeah.
Yeah, we were in separate houses or different places recording. And now we've both been vaccinated. So we are able to sit in the same room and speak to each other, see each other's smiling faces, and do this podcast.
Yeah, it's great. I'm so excited. And to celebrate the fact that we're getting to do this in person, I decided, I asked David, of course, if he would be okay if we did kind of a little bit absurd episode, a little bit of fun. We're going to be talking about the Walt Disney Company's relationship to nuclear science, which, I mean, that's not the first thing that comes to my mind when I think of Walt Disney.
Well, you've got that whole House of Tomorrow,
yeah,
you know, so
exactly.
There is that vibe that they've kind of been pushing forever.
Yep.
So, you know, that is something that Disney was ahead of the curve in a lot of things. And that was how they've been. Or one of the ways that they've been so successful up to today. We want to make sure to thank our
Atomic History Patron member. Thank you, guys. We appreciate it. Yeah, so to start off, I'm actually going to take us back to the spring of 2019 when there was suddenly a lot of news coverage. There were a couple podcasts coming out. There was suddenly like this buzz around this Florida law. And that was because a state representative named Bruce Anton began campaigning to get this law expunged. And I mean, this law is pretty old. It's from the very early days of Walt Disney World. You know, Walt Disney's attorneys, when they were securing permissions to build the city, the municipality, they were kind of setting up an autonomous government for Disney World, because that's, I mean, Walt really wanted to be able to do kind of whatever he wanted to in his own little city of tomorrow. And so some of the things that they secured are kind of a little bit, little crazy, very incongruous with what we think of Disney today.
Very future forward.
Yeah, yeah. He didn't want to limit himself. And so not only did his lawyers secure the rights to distill hard liquor, but he also made sure that should he ever decide to, Walt Disney would actually legally be allowed to build a nuclear reactor to fuel the Disney World parks and the town of Celebration, Florida, which if you're not familiar with Celebration, it's like a company town that was purpose built for resort employees to inhabit. In 1967, the Florida legislature went ahead and passed a bill that would allow the Disney Company to, again, if they ever decided to, build a nuclear reactor. And although neither this permit or the liquor distilling permit were ever used, Bruce Anton, this is again in about February, March of 2019, Bruce Anton brought this up, and some Florida citizens decided that they weren't particularly happy about the idea of a nuclear power plant that was run by the mouse. So
now this is kind of interesting timing just with this podcast, as I did a class yesterday with a group of students from here in Albuquerque or Corrales, which is right next door to Albuquerque, and it was on nuclear energy. And it was interesting that you say that, because the general mindset is the whole not in my backyard mindset. A lot of us think that nuclear is a wonderful option. Nuclear mm-hmm. should be part of the puzzle as long as you're not building one next door to me. And so that's something that in speaking with students, these were sixth graders, they had a lot of, you know, interesting just kind of insights that we as adults are, you know, kind of fixed in our ways, mm-hmm. you know, in that, okay, well, this is yes, this is no, this is, you know, black, this is white. But these kids were actually able to, you know, say, okay, well, what if you were to, you know, kind of make the laws to where people knew things were safe before. And it's kind of an interesting thing in speaking to kids mm-hmm. because it was dealing with this exact same thing of, yeah, we would love to have nuclear, just not right here.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and part of the problem is that when this was an idea in Walt's, you know, a sparkle in Walt's eye, the regulating bodies that we now have, the NRC, the DOE, you know, these governing commissions that make sure that plants are up to speed and all of this, they didn't exist yet. So, I mean, I'll talk about this a little bit later too, but the fact that we have those governing bodies now means that, you know, we can make reactors that aren't terrifying.
Well, yeah, and that again, you know, kind of circling back to, you know, a little bit there, was another one of the things that actually one of the students brought up was that they have these laws and things now that they can, we can be a little more secure in the fact that if they do build one, you know, there's not going to be some terrible incident or there won't be some crazy waste that's coming out of it. Because that was a question posed by another student saying, okay, well, what about all of the, you know, the wastewater and those kind of things? And it was neat to kind of be part of this, you know, interchange between these students where the one says, okay, well, what about, you know, like say the mm-hmm. pollutants mm-hmm. and things like that. And then the other one saying, well, we're setting up ways to make sure that these things don't happen. So it was neat to witness that. But like you say, the legislation that is on now, you know, that is, you know, that we're under now is a lot more safety forward.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, that's part of, you know, this shows how far ahead Walt Disney was. He was very ahead of his time as far as green energy and was really, really keen on making Epcot, his city of the future, as renewable and as green as possible. And I mean, you can still see this in the parks today. The Epcot is populated by electric cars. In 2016, the Walt Disney Company unveiled a giant 22-acre Mickey-shaped solar panel field that's helping power the parks, which
I think is mouse powered.
Yes, yeah.
We were actually my family and I went this last November and we, you know, we did everything safely, masks and all of those things. And because at the time you had to quarantine when you got back and we were very, you know, cautious with all of that. But there is actually surrounding Epcot mm-hmm. a whole new area that they're building, which is looking to be devoted to, you know, the energy end of things. Mm-hmm, so they're mm-hmm. actually building a large part of the park right now that is devoted to greener energy, you know, that will future power that park. So it was kind of neat to see. And it's surrounding the Epcot area there. Yeah.
That's really cool. Because when I was doing research for this, I saw future windmills. You know, these are all articles from 2019, but they kept mentioning over and over again this new Mickey-shaped solar panel
field. That's awesome.
But also the fact that they're building wind turbines to power the parks. It's great. He was very ahead of his time, and the company is trying to keep that up. And this hypothetical nuclear plant isn't the only connection that Disney has to the atomic age. There's a couple of other instances that are pretty clear that he was interested in this type of science, in this theme. The museum actually has a couple of these things in our collection. In 1947, Disney partnered with the Ingersoll Watch Company to create a wristwatch that was shaped like Donald Duck. It's really cute. His little arms go around and his little hands point. His hands actually glow in the dark. So,
what makes his hands glow in the dark? I ask knowingly.
That would be radium paint. We're talking about safety, but in 1947, we're still trying to figure things out.
They were learning. They were learning. Yes.
Yes. And I did a quick search to see if, because I thought, wow, it's really cool that the museum has this. And so I did a quick Google. There are two that are for sale, the same model on eBay. One is going for $800 and the other one is going for more than $2,000.
Wow. Yeah.
So these are really rare, really fascinating pieces of memorabilia. But alarmingly, neither of the eBay entries mention anything about the fact that they have raped them.
And that is an interesting thing because eBay has got some regulations there. Yeah. About selling these types of articles that have got your radioactive substances in it. Yeah, there's a lot of things that eBay does to be careful about that, even if it's something as small as a watch. So, yeah, I've spoken to people that, deal in these types of things, as I'm sure you have in collections, and they say, yeah, eBay's a little tricky. Yeah.
And they don't even mention, it's possible that the sellers don't even know. A glowing watch hand is a glowing watch hand, and they may not even know that they glow. You know what I mean? Right. Have you ever looked at your antiques in the dark?
Personally, I've got to say yes, but I'm a little different.
Yeah. Well, we know you walk around your house with black light.
Yes, going, yeah, woo! Yeah. I've done all of those things. Yeah, because I'm that guy.
Which is, that's fun. I don't blame you. So then a decade later, in 1957, after they had made these watches, there was an episode of a television series called Disneyland, where my mom actually talked to me about how she had seen some of these air, and they were really cool. They were very much in the spirit of Fantasia, where it's kind of like a behind the scenes, but also with animation. And they would go throughout the parks and just learn things. And yeah, well, this episode was called Our Friend the Atom. And it was actually hosted by a German physicist and science writer named Hans Haber. And he was most famous for his television appearances. So he was a little bit like a 1950s Bill Nye, I would imagine.
Very much so, yes.
So this episode was created as part of Dwight Eisenhower's Atoms for Peace campaign, which was this widespread propaganda campaign to get people to be more comfortable with the idea of nuclear science as a peaceful, it's not just the bomb.
Right.
I know that's what all of the headlines have said. It's not. You can also power things. You can, do all kinds of things with.
Well, and the Disney company also produced a fallout gas mask with the Mickey Mouse ears on them. They're extremely rare nowadays because the material just didn't last. But they made them so that children wouldn't be as nervous, about wearing a gas mask. But if you look these things up online, you'll have nightmares for weeks.
Ironically, they are terrifying.
I showed one to my daughter and she's like, I never need to see that again. Yeah, it is the making of horror movies right now. But they actually made it with the mindset of this is to comfort the child if indeed something like that were to happen and they were to need something like that.
Yeah. So actually, before this episode even aired, Disney also made it into a picture book by the same name, Our Friend the Atom. And this is, I'm pretty sure we have one in collections. This was released in 1956. So even before he put out the episode of Disneyland, he had Golden Press make this book for him.
which I would love to have a copy of.
Yeah. I'd like to read a little excerpt of the foreword that Walt Disney actually wrote himself to kind of give us an idea of how he felt about this. You know, because we don't have any evidence that he would have made a reactor, but we can see how he felt about it. So, fiction often has a strange way of becoming fact. Not long ago, we produced a motion picture based on the immortal tale 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, featuring the famous submarine Nautilus. According to that story, the craft was powered by a magic force. Today, the tale has come true. A modern namesake of the old ferry ship, the submarine Nautilus of the United States Navy, has become the world's first atom-powered ship. It is proof of the useful power of the atom that will drive the machines of our atomic age. The atom is our future. It is a subject everyone wants to understand, and so we long had plans to tell the story of the atom. In fact, we considered it so important that we embarked on several atomic projects. Of course, we don't pretend to be scientists. We are storytellers. But we combine the tools of our trade with the knowledge of experts. The story of
That's awesome.
Yeah. And this is something that, as you said, is deeply ingrained in the philosophy of Disneyland and Disney World, the edutainment and the
Imagineering.
Yes. Yeah. There's all of these, you know, mushed up words, but they mean something, and mm-hmm. they meant something to Walt Disney. To continue, the story of the atom is a fascinating tale of human quest for knowledge, a story of sorry.
I'm gonna do it while you're doing it. There you go.
The story of the atom is a fascinating tale of human quest for knowledge, a story of scientific adventure and success. Atomic science has borne many fruits, and the harnessing of the atom's power is only the spectacular end result. It came about through the work of many inspired men whose ideas formed a kind of chain reaction of thoughts. These men came from all civilized nations and from centuries as far back as 400 BC. Atomic science began as positive creative thought. It has created modern science with its many benefits for mankind. In this sense, our book tries to make it clear to you that we can indeed look upon the atom as our friend. So this is clearly, he's acknowledging the fact that there are unpeaceful uses for the atom. He's very much, and this is very much of its time, the fact that he uses, you know, civilized nations.
And right. Yeah. The terminology.
The men who.
Right.
But it's clear that he's trying to convince the reader that the atom has many uses, that it's not just for war. It's not just a tool of destruction.
I like the part that says atomic science began as positive and creative thought. I think that really kind of shows where he was going there.
Yeah. Well, and I would really, really recommend looking up both the episode of Disneyland, which there are parts of it available on YouTube, and also just Googling the picture book. It's absolutely gorgeous, very stylized, and a bunch of the illustrations are available online. I'm honestly pretty surprised that these things are available online, as the Disney company is notoriously protective of its IP. Its intellectual property is very regulated. So I can't vouch for how legal, you know, the YouTube videos are. I'm pretty sure that the sites that have the book are from libraries, and they have copyright.
And it's fine. Also, I know that some of it you can find on the internet, and it was not copywritten by Disney because mm-hmm. it was in conjunction with the government at the time. So he did some that were we would consider propaganda.
Sure. And this is part of Adams for Peace.
And it could be, I don't know that. That's, you know, speculation. Yeah. But some of it wasn't copywritten because it was made for the government at the time.
So I would definitely recommend checking these out. They're absolutely beautiful and really, really interesting. Anyways, the fact that Disney made this episode and put so much work into this book, it suggests that, again, although we don't have the evidence, it was certainly possible that Walt Disney was serious about powering his Florida park with nuclear power. His original idea would have certainly been connected to the fact that he was setting up this autonomous government in Florida. Reedy Creeks is what it's called. It's like this municipality that it's still in effect today. Something that I heard when I was doing research for this is if you ever go into a Disney restaurant and you look for a food safety certification, mm-hmm. you're not going to find one. That doesn't mean that, you know, they're not taking good care of their customers, but it means that they don't have to follow the same rules.
Because they are their own municipality. Yeah,
absolutely.
When we went, in November, it really was refreshing to see, if not a little bit eerie, the measures that Disney took for safety. We did a lot of research before we went. The trip was going to be for my daughter's graduation and all these things. And so it was a matter of, it's time. We really got to take her. And so when we went, it was, you know, with a lot of research into, okay, is Disney going to be safe? You know, we didn't want to put our kids at risk or anything like that. But you saw when you were there, the extreme measures that they would take and how Disney magical they were mm-hmm. with making those not seem intimidating or frightening. Yeah. You know, I guess it's back, you know, to that gas mask idea of, you know, we're going to be safe, but we want you to still be in that surreal area that is Disney, you know, the beautiful, magical place that it is, which this is not a commercial for Disneyland. Oh, yeah. I just so happened to go and it really was an amazing experience. But they really were very conscientious of safety and they were able to do a lot of those things because they are their own micro government.
Yeah. 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 And I mean, personally, I have some pretty strong opinions about Disney, both brand and company, both positive and negative. I mean, there was a point where I thought about becoming a Disney historian and then thought that maybe I would be too susceptible to kind of the
Disney mindset.
Yes, there's a culture. Yes, there is a culture.
Very much so.
And I like to be able to stay a little bit critical mm-hmm. because, I mean, they're not without fault, but the suspension of disbelief in a Disney park is one of the most truly magical. It's so fun. And there's a reason that these parks are so successful, even though they were built in the 50s and 60s.
Right.
So.
And it's that attention to perception
mm-hmm.
And the attention to safety.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they were able to stay open. And mm-hmm. to, you know, Disney World, Disneyland actually close down.
Yeah.
But they are, Disneyland is not, doesn't have the autonomy that Disney World has. Yeah. And so, you know, because of that attention to safety, there, you know, cases were so minuscule, if at all,
mm-hmm.
That were happening, you know, transmissions there that they were able to actually stay open. So it is that attention to safety and still being able to make it somewhere that you would want to be.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's, I mean, personally, if I could choose a random company to run up a nuclear reactor, I'd probably pick Disney. I don't know. I mean,
I never thought about it before, but yeah. Well, they know how to run, one, the corporate end of it.
Yeah.
And to make sure that things they want to happen can happen.
Mm-hmm.
And they're, you know, are very attentive to the details of safety.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, looking at the economic side of a power plant like this, it may have been viable at the time that this law was passed, considering the amount of energy that Epcot and Walt Disney World use every year. Currently, the parks cost over $10 billion a year to run and use more than 1 billion kilowatt hours of electricity. The resulting bill is over $100 million a year. So the initial cost of building the power plant, of building a nuclear power plant, is very high. It's in the billions of dollars. And it would take several decades, like 30 or 40 years, for the plant to pay for itself. But this still isn't inconceivable for a company that routinely drops like a quarter of $1 billion on individual films and makes the money back. So the other part of this for nowadays, and the reason that I think this state representative Anton was concerned about this, is that building a nuclear reactor nowadays it's more viable.
Right.
There are a lot more hoops to jump through. Like I said, you know, the DOE didn't exist, the EPA were not yet created. But nowadays, small modular nuclear reactors fit into this Tomorrowland vision pretty easily. A modular reactor is compact. It can't melt down. It doesn't shut down to refuel. It can operate for several decades. So that 30 or 40 year, you know, benchmark is not really super concerning. It creates no emissions after the initial carbon cost of, you know, building a plant. It can ramp up and down quickly to load follow their solar and future wind farms. So this is also what happened in Texas. This can kind of prevent that. This makes electricity generated by nuclear power much less volatile and susceptible to cold and whatever winter weather conditions. And it's cheaper than anything else except for gas power. So this technology very much feels like it's the future of America now. And in the 1950s and 60s, this was absolutely like a vision of the future. So, I mean, as we talked about earlier, the main problem right now, besides the initial cost, obviously, is the social stigma that nuclear power often faces. You know, Three Mile Island, Chernobyl, Fukushima, people hear about these things over and over and over again. And the difference is that with current technology, it's really very safe and nearly carbon neutral. Like, it's really... Yeah, it's frustrating.
Well, because nuclear is pun slightly intended, such a hot button topic, you know, when something does happen, the presses and media and people want to know so much more about it. You know, it's huge news that something happened. Mm-hmm. Whereas, you know, if the same type of thing were to happen in a different field, you know, power generation or whatever, it wouldn't receive the press and it wouldn't receive the attention because people are interested in nuclear because we don't know much about it. And not knowing something, as we've spoken, the safety, you know, episodes and things, anything we don't know about, we're afraid of. I mean, mm-hmm. we're humans. That's how this works. Yeah. We're one, intrigued by it. We want to know more about it.
Yeah.
And two, we're kind of afraid of it. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, the amount of media and the amount of interest that comes with these disasters really, I don't want to say blow them out of proportion because that's not necessarily the case, but
they are devastating.
It gives them a lot more
time
in our vision
than exactly. another one would. That's what people remember, as opposed to, you know, we don't have a big headline. You know, nuclear power plant has run for 50 years with no incident and has powered these towns for half a century without any problems. You know, that's not a headline.
Right. And you'll have ones, you know, where there were miners that were stuck in mines and that would get mm-hmm. top billing headline news until mm-hmm. the second that they were rescued and you don't even hear it anymore.
Yeah.
Whereas, Fukushima was actually back in the news over the last couple of weeks, you know, and because they're saying, okay, well, what about the water now? And these kind of things. It's something that continues to intrigue because we, as you know, as a whole, don't mm-hmm. have that kind of knowledge about nuclear.
Yeah.
And so we're a lot more interested and afraid.
Yeah. And it's a matter of when things go wrong, they go really wrong. But with the technology now, it's so much less likely that things will go wrong, that it's on par with any other type of energy. You know, there's always a cost, there's always a risk. And again, just my opinion, I think it's worth it. I think it's worth exploring, certainly.
Always. It should be a piece of the puzzle.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah. And this is, I mean, this is why it's really quite incongruous, kind of like silly and absurd to say, you know, the Walt Disney Corporation is building a nuclear reactor. Like it's, that's why it's funny, is because of the implications and what the public knows about
because
it.
Half of your brain says, what are they thinking? The other half says, yeah, of course they are.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. The option is still open. Bruce Anton's campaign to revoke the rights to get that law expunged, it fell through. So what do you think, David? I think I would take some convincing as far as Disney running one. But like I said, I mean,
I myself, being the geek that I am, I'd ride that ride. Mm-hmm. You know, as you can take Disney's ride through the reactor, yeah. I'd be on that ride. I'd be like, I want to sit in the front. But it would be something that I think Disney would have to do a lot of convincing.
Oh, yeah. This is not something that would be viable in the next even decade.
And really, my main concerns would be the volatility of the area. Nature-wise, I mean, it is an area that while Disney, you know, Disney World there is really in a fairly safe spot, there are a lot of hurricanes, there are a lot of things that go through. And the things that affect the water, you know, as we saw with Fukushima, you know, something coming in that would be completely off the wall, out of control, would be what could make that difference. And so I think that would be the end that they would have to, because they're not going to do it on site. I mean, it's not going to be like there's the giant golf ball thing and there's the reactor, and so I think placement, you know, and the volatility of nature in that area would be a concern, you know, and they would have to be able to, and which, I mean, Disney does studies. That's what Disney does. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I'm sure that they could present you with whatever. And I personally, if they came to the point where they said, okay, we can do this safely, I'd be like, all right, I'm cool with that. Yeah. Because, I mean, if you look at the, you know, the wattage that they use in a year, a decent power plant out there could not only power Disney World, but could power, you know, the rest of Southern Florida, you know, in addition to. And I think that would be their Disney selling point is, hey, we can also provide this, you know, this energy. And I don't know that, but the potential is there. Absolutely. To make a big difference in a lot of people's lives down there.
Yeah, I think so. Okay, well, what about Mickey Whiskey or Donald Vodka or my roommate said Goofy Tequila?
Goofy Tequila, yeah. Now, I personally, I am teetotal. I don't drink, but I may have a collector's bottle of Goofy Tequila. Yeah, because that sounds like fun. You know, one of the things about the parks that is, you know, is so magical is you don't have the people stumbling around too much.
Yeah.
But they also have, you know, some after hours experiences that I think would definitely, you know, people would benefit from.
Yeah. I mean, I know that now you can drink in California Adventure, in Disneyland in California. Obviously in California.
Right, it's this is California
Adventure. Yeah. But isn't there also like an Epcot, like?
Yes, but they do have
a little bit. I've heard some things about how they've actually had to, there was a, like, it was called the Around the World, where you would go and drink at every single
in Epcot,
country.
Yeah.
And they had
they
to
would
like,
have whatever.
Mm-hmm. Get people to stop doing that because people were not being responsible.
And it's anytime you put people in the mix, you've got a problem.
Yeah.
I think it would be a fun concept. Like, say, I personally wouldn't, you know, partake, but I could definitely collect some really cool bottles.
Yeah. And that's what I'm in it for too. I want to see what the design is like.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
But yeah, so that's our episode. I hope you enjoyed yourself. I hope it was a nice light breath of Disney flavored churro smelling air in your week.
Yeah. Well, this one was definitely fun for me. I really had a great time actually sitting across the table from you, Anna.
So nice.
Yeah, and it really gave it a little more personality, not mm-hmm. being able to, or, you know, not having to look at you on the little screen, but being able to see you in real life smiling across the table. So I've really enjoyed this one. Thank you for putting all this stuff together.
Absolutely.
And thanks doing the research.
Thanks for doing all the tech and the editing. And
definitely.
Thank you to our Atomic History Patreon members. You guys make this possible. I know we say it every time, but we mean it.
We do appreciate you.
Thank you. We have a lot of fun doing this, and it's thanks to you. So
awesome.
Well, and all of our listeners.
Definitely.
Some of you, we appreciate you too. Keep listening and tell your friends.
Yeah, we've noticed that we do have listeners across the globe, and that's pretty neat. Mm-hmm. So if you're listening to us somewhere other than the United States, send us an email. Say, hey, we're listening to you, because it's great to have you listening in other places also.
So you can email us at info@nuclearmuseum.org. And that's info@nuclearmuseum.org.
Yes. Well, thank you very much, Anna. And as we end everything, even if you're wearing those nice white four-fingered Mickey gloves, mm-hmm. don't forget to wash your hands.
Radioactive Waves has been presented by the National Museum of Nuclear Science and History. Join us next time for more interviews, histories, and insights on topics like the Manhattan Project, science and pop culture, the atomic age, and the differences between nuclear fact and fiction.